The proposal to the permanent fund would be that they view these tax credits very much like a state of Alaska bond.
The state makes an unusual pitch to the Permanent Fund Board. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, less access to state government as funding cuts close legislative offices for half a day a week.
I can accept a half-day closure on Fridays to see how it works. It saves us enough money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board had an unusual visitor at their meeting today. Former Attorney General Craig Richard showed up to pitch an unconventional investment idea, oil and gas tax credits. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Governor Bill Walker's administration has a problem. Or rather, several of Alaska's smaller oil and gas companies have a problem. Those companies have earned tax credits from the state for things like exploration work. But for the last 2 years, the governor has vetoed payments for those credits. That means companies are holding IOUs from the state with no idea when they'll actually get paid. The administration estimates the state now owes more than $700 million in those IOUs. And in the past, companies could sell the rights to these credits to, say, a bank or an outside investor. But that market has dried up. And that, former Attorney General Craig Richards told the Permanent Fund Board, that creates an opportunity.
The proposal to the Permanent Fund would be that they view these tax credits very much like a state of Alaska bond.
That's Richards explaining the proposal in an interview after his presentation. Richards was a Permanent Fund Board member himself until he resigned as Attorney General in June. He's currently on contract with the governor's office, where he's been brainstorming solutions to the oil tax credit dilemma. And he thinks he's identified an opening.
You have the potential to purchase a credit from the state for yields that are something like 10%. Whereas if you were to go buy a state of Alaska or a state of Washington bond, it might yield 2%.
Sounds pretty good, right? Richard says the tax credit certificates are like bonds issued by the state. They're debt we have to pay. The difference is there's no deadline, so it may be several years. But many companies need that money sooner rather than later. They were planning on it to pay for next year's work or took out loans against the credits, and now they have to pay those loans back. Right now, they don't have many options. They can sell the certificates to bigger companies on the North Slope, which can use them to offset future taxes. But for various reasons, the credits aren't actually worth all that much to those companies. What you need, Richard says, is an outside investor who isn't bound by the same rules as North Slope producers. They might be willing to buy the rights to those credits for, say, 70% of their face value, on the assumption that at some point, the state is going to pay the full amount. I asked if he would go for this, if he were still on the Permanent Fund Board.
If I could get the tax credits at 70 cents on the dollar, absolutely. If I can only get them at 95 cents on the dollar, probably not.
Permanent Fund Board members only asked a few questions and didn't give any real indication what they thought of the plan. Kara Moriarty of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association was also listening. Her group represents several companies who are owed credits, and she said she still has plenty of questions. But no matter what, she said, the key issue remains the same.
Whether you're paying an investor, whether it's the permanent fund or a private bank, or you're paying the companies themselves, at the end of the day, it still comes down to when is the state going to pay it?
And for now, that's a question with no clear answer. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
The Alaska legislature will now close offices on Friday afternoons. 22 Alaska legislative information offices around the state are shuttered for half a day as a cost-saving measure. The offices will be closed every Friday afternoon while the legislature is not in session. The legislature's in-house administrative council voted the action through 9-1 yesterday. The legislative council's vote, which also included a reduction in payroll for support staff, is expected to cover a $298,000 cut in the legislature's operating budget for the current budget year. Some legislators on the council expressed an appetite to cut further and close the offices for the entire day on Fridays. Senator Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, chairs the council and said that could still happen.
I can accept a half-day closure on Fridays to see how it works. It saves us enough money. And in the future, if we find that that's still not enough, when there are additional cuts, then maybe we should be going to a full day on Friday. But I think this is a step towards solving our problem.
The information offices are staffed by nonpartisan employees of the Legislative Affairs Agency. Those employees facilitate teleconferencing for Alaskans to remotely attend legislative meetings. They also serve as a public point of contact and as interpreters of what's often an arcane lawmaking process. Sue Cotter manages the legislature's information and teleconferencing. She told the council that in some of the remote offices, her staff also help process permanent fund dividend documents. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management formally rejected requests to extend the public comment period on the proposed Cook Inlet lease sale on Thursday. Bob Shavelson is the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper. He says the timing of the public comment period excluded many Kenai Peninsula residents who were traveling or fishing over the summer.
The federal government issued its public notice in the middle of July when everyone was fishing, so no one had an opportunity to digest the 600-plus pages of the environmental impact statement and make reasonable comments.
Several other organizations also submitted requests for an extension of the public comment period, including United Cook Inlet Drift Association, the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, and the Natural Resources Defense Council. The proposed lease sale covers just over 1 million acres on the Outer Continental Shelf in Cook Inlet. If approved, companies would bid on rights to explore, develop, and extract oil and natural gas in the region. The bidding process would begin next June. By law, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management must conduct an environmental analysis and solicit public testimony before the lease sale can be approved. The 45-day public comment period ends Tuesday, September 6th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unconventional summer camp in Homer.
Do you guys know what rigor is?
Rigor mortis.
Yeah, rigor mortis. So pretty much, he's still a little stiff. Which is good, because that means that he's fresh.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Members of the One People Canoe Society are traveling this week from Alaska to North Dakota to paddle in protest over a controversial pipeline. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has asked paddlers from around the country to show support with a float down the Missouri River. Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Richard Peterson says Doug Chilton and DeAndre King left on the ferry from Juneau Wednesday night.
It was kind of a last-minute deal because a lot of the folks but the One People Canoe Society are actually canoeing here to Kasan tomorrow. So they really just got together what they could. They got their Raven canoe together and they just needed some financial support.
On Saturday, there's a ceremony in the village of Kasan for the restoration of the Sunai Hat Whale House. But Peterson says Chilton and King decided to go to North Dakota after the chairman of the Standing Rock Tribe put out a call asking for help. Peterson says they'll be displaying a Central Council flag. He says it's an important time to show support. He sees similarities with British Columbia mining and Southeast waterways.
You know, we're fighting here on transboundary issues. And we don't know what turn that's going to take, and we may need people to stand with us as well.
If the pipeline is built, 500,000 barrels of crude could flow from North Dakota to Illinois. For it to get there, it would have to cross under the Missouri River, Standing Rock Reservation's water source. Peterson thinks it could take 2 days for Chilton and King to reach North Dakota. More Alaskans will have affordable access to mobile phones and broadband internet thanks to a change in federal communications rules and funding. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Rural communities throughout the United States benefit from what's called the Universal Service Fund. It subsidizes expansion of and improvements to telecommunication systems. It also keeps costs in small communities closer to those in big cities. The Federal Communications Commission recently adopted a Universal Service Fund plan for Alaska. It includes more than $1 billion to be spent over the next decade. Communities from Adak to Kotzebue to Ketchikan will see improved service.
Broadly, it just excludes Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, so pretty much any areas outside of that.
Christine O'Connor is executive director of the Alaska Telephone Association.
It's going to vary by company, but you'll see speeds going up, more locations being reached over the next 10 years, starting immediately.
The plan requires wireless providers to deploy 4G LTE or better mobile service to at least 85% of rural Alaskans. That's almost 10 times more than the current percentage. Broadband speeds will be at least 10 megabits per second for downloading and 1 megabit per second for uploading. The goal is to provide that service to 90% of rural Alaska, up from the current 60%. Each of the 15 companies involved will develop their own plans and timelines, and there are options other than the Alaska plan within the Universal Service Fund. Michael Garrett of the Alaska Power and Telephone Company says the business will add more fiber optic cables to expand bandwidth.
Look for us to be able to provide a better value service for what they pay us for, increased data caps, faster speeds, hopefully at least the price that we're offering now or lower.
Alaska Power and Telephone provides internet service in Southeast Petersburg, Wrangell, Haines, Skagway, and Prince of Wales Island. It also serves Tok and several other interior communities. Many of the companies involved have already expanded their services, but Alaska Telephone Association President Ed Cushing of Ketchikan's KPU Telecommunications says there are limits without federal assistance.
We are obligated and required by the FCC to charge the equivalent of urban rates. Well, it's financially impossible unless you have a subsidy behind the scenes that makes it possible.
Some of the companies involved are small, serving a particular community or part of a region. But Alaska's largest telecommunications provider will also be taking advantage of the funding. Heather Handyside is a spokeswoman for GCI, which has about 200,000 customers.
This dedicated 10-year investment from, you know, partnership with federal government means that it helps us make a business case for bringing these services to more communities in rural Alaska.
Expanding and speeding up broadband and cell phone service will help rural businesses and schools. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
From underneath the roads to inside our homes, insulation is everywhere in Alaska, but traditional foam board is energy intensive to produce and often ends up as plastic litter in oceans and waterways. A group of researchers at the University of Alaska Anchorage are working to develop an environmentally friendly alternative. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Eric Keto has the story.
This is all experimental. Nobody has ever done this. We didn't have any clue of how this would work.
That's Professor Philippe Omstislavsky, and gathered around him are students from the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP. The high schoolers have spent weeks this summer in the lab, designing molds and filling them with a coarse tan-gray mixture. They're finally getting the chance to see how their experiments turned out.
It works. I'm going to take it off.
I think it's stuck to the thing.
The objects are light and foam-like. Some are a little crumbly, while others keep their structure as they're passed around the room for everyone to admire. They all have one thing in common. They were grown from an unlikely local substance, mushrooms.
We have long history in the north of using mushrooms for food, medicine,
Now we are experimenting with using them for insulation.
Over the past year and a half, Omstislavsky and his team at UAA have been developing a new type of insulation designed to overcome the environmental issues caused by conventional foam products on the market today.
We have problems with particulates in our waterways, in the ocean. Pink board or blue board that we use for insulation is typically made out of oil-derived polymers that are non-biodegradable.
The researchers instead use a mix of local fungus cultures, sawdust, and other natural ingredients to grow their own biomaterial blocks in the lab. When Amstislavsky shares his research with his friends and colleagues, they're often a little skeptical.
Yeah, so the first question we always get, is this going to kill me if I touch it? You have to explain, yes, it is fungus, but it's not toxic. It's not going to jump on you and try to take over your body.
The researchers still have a lot of questions to answer when it comes to determining if the new biomaterial will be a viable alternative to foam insulation. They need to test whether it can handle freezing and thawing and make sure it won't get waterlogged. Back in the lab, Anchorage High Schooler Charity Ropati from ANSEP is measuring her own recently grown insulation block, designed to be used in future home construction.
I didn't know that living organisms could be used to build these kind of things. I was like, wow, like I could actually use this kind of stuff.
Ropati isn't the only one who sees potential in the biomaterial. Omstislavsky and his partner have been invited to Washington, D.C. to showcase their insulation at the University Startups Demo Day later this month, a national competition. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Eric Keto in Anchorage.
Homer Volunteer Fire Department has had a lot of good news lately. They received $1 million from the city to remodel their fire station, plus two grants. KBBI's Dacia Eaton has more.
Homer Fire Chief Bob Painter says the project has been underway for about 2 weeks. The remodel is the result of 2.5 years of planning. It costs $1 million and was funded by the city of Homer after the department was removed from plans for a new public safety building.
The price tag just got too high. So they came to me, the public safety building committee, and the city came and said, what do we need to do to the existing fire station to make it usable for the next 15 years plus?
The answer was a lot. Original flooring will be replaced, a diesel exhaust removal system installed, and concrete floors in the fire truck bays redone, among other things. Homer Fire Department is a combination department. They have about 30 volunteers, 5 full-time staff, and 2 seasonal employees. Painter says the department's call volume has increased over the past decade, and he estimates they'll likely respond to around 700 calls this year. One additional improvement that Painter's pleased about is that new bunk rooms will be added upstairs to house volunteers.
We're going to add 2,000 square feet of additional living space, and that's going to incorporate right now, the plan is calling for 5 bunk rooms. These are going to be individual bunk rooms that volunteers can live in around the clock. And we're hoping to partner maybe with the college or with students that have Firefighter 1, maybe EMT, that can live in the station, and part of the room and board will be responding to calls when they're not otherwise engaged in study or work.
Painter says the building was last improved during a 1995 seismic retrofit. The department had 2 other reasons to celebrate this week. First, the city of Homer received a Staffing for Adequate Fire and Emergency Response, or SAFER grant, through Homeland Security for an assistant fire chief at the department. It's a 2-year grant that fully funds an assistant chief position, something that's been unheard of for many years due to budget constraints. Also this week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Office on Monday delivered a new ambulance to Chief Painter in Anchorage. The total cost of the ambulance was $175,000. USDA RD Alaska provided $25,000 in funding. The state of Alaska supplied $70,000. And the city of Homer picked up the remaining cost. In Homer, I'm Dacia Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message brought to you by Alaska PTAC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, the end of summer camp. As fall approaches, everyone will be asking kids the dreaded question, what did you do this summer? But a group of them in Homer who attended the Marine Mammal Mystery Camp should at least have some interesting answers. KBBI reporter Shayla Farzan has the story.
The phrase summer camp usually brings to mind images of toasted marshmallows, campfires, and wobbly canoe trips. One thing you won't find at a typical summer camp? Bones.
That's a really strange-shaped bone. It reminds me of a camel.
But for the kids at this year's Marine Mammal Mystery Camp, bones are a pretty big part of the experience. Instead of making s'mores, these kids are putting together a sea lion skeleton.
This one goes there. This one goes there.
Every year, the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies and Homer host the 5-day, 4-night camp at Peterson Bay Field Station. Campers range in age from 9 to 15, but they have one thing in common. They're seriously into marine mammals. Homer resident Lee Post, a.k.a. Mr. Bone, helps the campers arrange the 10-foot stellar sea lion skeleton on 3 folding tables.
For a lot of these kids, that's the first time they've really gotten to hold real bones or look at them.
The curved rib bones and knobby vertebrae look like weathered pieces of wood. Putting the skeleton together has been a little difficult, says Post, because some of the bones are missing.
Did this finger break?
That finger's missing.
With a total of 20 kids, this is the biggest marine mammal camp they've had since it began in 2011. They do a variety of activities, but the whale watch is clearly the highlight of the week. The next morning, the campers pile onto the Terega, a 30-foot boat painted canary yellow. Captain Carl Stolzfus carefully maneuvers around Gull Island in Kachemak Bay. The rocky little island is covered in dozens of seabirds. Local naturalist Axel Gillum points out the different seabirds. He's one of the counselors leading the camp.
Oh, the ones with the long necks, those are called cormorants.
Captain Carl scans the horizon, looking for the spray of a whale surfacing.
So what you guys want to look and listen for is the blow. So when the whale comes up to the surface and go, psh.
They peer through binoculars, jostling for a spot at the edge of the boat. The glossy dark skin of a humpback appears above the water for a few moments.
There she blows!
There she blows!
Then the whale dives again, showing its curved tail flukes.
Oh my gosh!
Later in the week, the campers are back in Homer. They cluster around a plastic folding table under a pop-up tent. They're about to watch a sea otter necropsy. Adriana Ferrello-Sheehan is with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. She lays out her dissection tools on the table, along with a pile of plastic vials. The otter on the folding table is 5 feet long from head to tail and about 80 pounds. He was found washed up on the Homer spit, but Adriana isn't sure why he died. That's what the necropsy is for.
Do you guys know what rigor is?
Rigor mortis.
Yeah, rigor mortis. So pretty much he's still a little stiff, which is good because that means that he's fresh.
Adriana is a bit like a detective collecting evidence. She takes tooth samples, whiskers, fur, urine, and feces. She also collects tiny pieces of the otter's organs to send away for analysis, including his heart and liver.
His heart's huge! Can I hold it?
What's this little gas-looking filled thing
is that
here?
The gallbladder.
No.
That's the stomach.
Stomach, yeah, stomach.
She carefully dissects the heart, revealing a huge blood clot.
It's a really, really big clot.
Wow.
Like this?
Inside one of the otter's main arteries, near its legs, is another big clot.
So you see how thick it is, and you can actually feel the jello feel that we were feeling with those clots.
Clotting in the heart and arteries is a good indication that this otter died from a bacterial infection, says Adriana. Last year, several hundred otters died around Kachemak Bay from Streptococcus bacteria. She's quick to point out that while this type of bacteria can be fatal for otters, humans can't catch it. For over an hour, the campers are completely engrossed in the process.
Whoa, it's all sticky!
Oh, it's super sticky, cool!
It's not hard to imagine future marine mammal scientists in the group, especially the ones that push to the front and pepper Adriana with questions.
What is that?
It's a lunch.
What are you doing again? cool.
For AK, I'm Shayla Farzan.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Will Schlemgen in Eagle River. Will is originally from California and is just starting his second year at UAA.
In Alaska, the whole state's got kind of that small town mentality, I think. Like, it's so easy to see people, like, you know, everywhere. You always, like, you go out and you see somebody you know. Eagle River's not that big. And Anchorage, even though people like have only lived in Alaska, think it's big, compared to like cities down the lower 48, is not big at all. Appreciation of the outdoors. I know you can do that in California too, but it gets so hot in the summer that I just kind of felt like staying inside all the time. But out here, I'm hiking almost every day. Like last summer, I've been going hiking all the time, like fishing, just outdoors is like huge up here. Balancing work, school, and social life is a huge like learning curve. There's a really steep learning curve, but it's one of the most important things to going to college. We have some of the worst dressed people, I would say. Actually, I think we were rated as the worst dressed state in the United States. I think a lot of the stereotypes are somewhat based in fact, like Alaska's full of like outdoorsy people, like because it is, and like everybody has a gun, because there's a lot of people that own guns in Alaska, or everybody's a dog. I think all my neighbors have dogs, like everybody's dogs. So I think that despite a lot of misconceptions people have about Alaska, there's a lot that's actually based in fact.
Will Schlemgen lives in Eagle River. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shayla Farzan and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz and Eric Keto in Anchorage, Jeremy Shea, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Shayla Farzan and Daisha Eaton in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.